Before I go any further, I want to acknowledge that this talk is taking place on the ancestral territories of Indigenous peoples, all peoples of color, as defined in this given cultural moment, suffer under white supremacy. And so to continue and to make a really key point that to understand white supremacy, we must understand our history and we must be able to trace that history into the present because it is never really the past and it is never separate. And to proceed without acknowledging that we are on ancestral territories, I think would be remiss. Does anyone know whose ancestral territories these are? Okay, Duwamish. And yet again, the Duwamish just last year were denied federal recognition. So the past is never separate from the present. So in order for us to talk about white supremacy, we really have to kind of lay down a foundation of what racism really is and how we come to, I really appreciated the reading of the letter from the Birmingham jail, to have a shallow understanding, right? We're talking about white progressives and what sets us up to have such a struggle with these concepts or these terms, right? And I said this before, I actually think white progressives, of which I am one, are actually the most difficult and the most challenging. Because the degree to which we think we're fine with all of this because we don't believe in racism and we're open-minded and we have friends, we see ourselves as really exempt from any further examination or engagement. And so I wanna really, as I move forward, really have us keep thinking, what is my part in this, right? In order to do that, we have to be on the same page of what we're talking about. And these terms often get used interchangeably, right? So prejudice is prejudgment. All humans have it. It's not humanly possible not to. We absorb it across our lifespans from multiple sources. It is not just what our parents taught us. And in fact, our parents taught us much, much deeper messages than what they said. So when we say, my parents taught me, we're usually referring to the words they spoke, but not the practice of their lives, which is vastly more powerful. So all of us have prejudgment, and when we act on it, we are now discriminating. All humans do it, and the vast majority of the prejudice and the discrimination is unconscious, so at the implicit level, right? So we can remove the word reverse from this discussion, right? Everybody go, uh-huh. Okay. When we get, however, into a group's collective bias backed by legal authority and institutional control, it is transformed. And it's no longer dependent on any individual intentions, self-image, action. The entire system will reproduce that bias, which will advantage the group that controls the institutions and can embed their bias into them, and disadvantage the groups that do not. Okay, so it gets embedded into all institutions and also into cultural definitions of what's normal, what's real, whose reality is attested to and whose is not. Who behaves correctly? Who displays proper emotions in the appropriate context? Who values education and how is education even defined, right? Who's beautiful, who's valuable, and who gets to set those parameters, right? So again, you have a group who controls the institutions and is in the position to embed and infuse their bias across the entire fabric of the society. So it's no longer dependent on our individual intentions, right? It's kind of the default, the status quo. Right? So I want to use an example from one form of oppression, sexism, to launch us into talking about racism, and then from that, this concept of white supremacy. I'm going to back up for a minute, though, because it's a teach-in, I feel like I need to explain, but I want to take a minute to position myself in the room and in the conversation. So I'm white. I don't know if you noticed, but do check me out. I'm white, and I am speaking primarily to other white people, because part of being white is to be socialized not to understand the meaning of being white, right? To be white is to be socialized to see someone as having race, but not really me. And to not see it as relevant in any way, so that I should be standing in front of several hundred people drawing your attention to it as if it's relevant. Right? That's what it means to be white. That's certainly how my life has been shaped by being white, right? To have it profoundly affect every moment of my consciousness, at the same time to see myself as really unracialized. So I'm very clear today, after decades and decades of study and struggle and mistake making and relationship building and mentorship from patient and brilliant people of color, that I'm white, that I have a white frame of reference, I have a white worldview, and I move through the world with a white experience. And it is not just a universal human experience. And I just need to say that sometimes spiritual-oriented or religious-oriented folks, because this is such a strong narrative, you know, we're all God's children, we all bleed under the skin, that narrative functions to deny in the here and now the reality of race and how it shapes our lives differently. So I want to be really clear about it. And as an insider to whiteness, an insider who spent decades struggling to understand what it means, I say that because just being white does not set you up to understand what it means, right? Not in this culture. In this culture, being white actually sets you up not to understand what it means. It sets you up to feel umbrage that anyone would suggest that they could know anything about you just because you're white. So heads up, all the white folks in the room, I am going to generalize all the next hour, and I am going to suggest that we can know something about you and me and each other because we are white. Yes, we are individuals. We are also members of a group that is profoundly important in this culture that we're in. And our challenge is to let go of this individualism, let go of all the ways you may be thinking, gosh, if she just knew about this about me, she'd know I was different. Which if you're thinking that, you're not showing me that you're different. our challenge is, there's a lot of challenges, but one is to let go of this individualism and be willing to grapple with what it means to be a member of this group in a society that is profoundly separate and unequal by race. Please, right? So what does it mean? And then how did my individual personal story set me up to participate in this system? It did not exempt anybody. No matter what you tell me about how you grew up, it didn't exempt you from the society you live in. So that's how you can use your individualism to understand how race shapes your life, right? Not to exempt you from that understanding or the implications. The other challenge for white folks is, I can't imagine a single person in this room who is white doesn't have an opinion on racism. I've actually never met a white person who didn't have an opinion on racism. If you're not sure about it, just bring it up the next time you go out to dinner with a bunch of white folks. Bring up racism and watch what happens, right? We all have opinions. But if we have not devoted years of sustained study, struggle, and focus on this topic, we have a shallow understanding as just articulated earlier. We cannot have the complex, nuanced understanding of the arguably most complex, nuanced social dilemma since the beginning of this country without sustained and deep examination, struggle, and work. So no, a trip to Costa Rica does not count as sustained, I know my white progressives, sustained study and struggle, right? So the other challenge for us is humility, because shallow knowledge and arrogance is really problematic. Okay, so that's my challenge to you. And if we use the example of women's suffrage, and I'm going to use, I'm very clear about intentionally the language I'm going to use. I'm going to use the language we are taught in school. So, when did women get the right to vote in the U.S.? 1920. Who gave women the right to vote? Men. Was there any other possible way for women to get it? No. Why not? Because we literally were not controlling the institutions. We could not grant ourselves the right to vote. Could we be mean to a man? I'm sure. one-on-one, right? We could be prejudiced, we could discriminate, but women as a group could not deny men their civil rights. Could men as a group deny women their civil rights? Yes. That is a significant difference, and that is why language is critical, because it allows us to include the reality of systematic institutionalized power, right? Okay. So today, if men as a group want to deny women their right to vote, could they? You just have to trust me, about 6 months ago, that was harder for most people to answer that question. Yes, because this illustrates another very critical dimension of power, institutionalized power, is that it is deeply embedded, historic, it is not fluid, it doesn't change overnight, and it's so normalized and taken for granted that we stop seeing it. So let's just look at some statistics from 2017. Fortune 500 CEOs, 98% male. Top 10 richest Americans, all male. Congress, 81% male. Republican side, 90%. Presidency and vice presidency, always 100%. Current cabinet, 91%. U.S. mayors, 82%. U.S. governors, 92%. I could go on. We live in patriarchy. And it didn't end in 1920. And it wouldn't have ended if Hillary Clinton had become president, right? All systems of oppression can allow for exceptions. So by definition, oppression is a one-way, deeply embedded, historic imbalance of power, and so there is also no reverse form of oppression. So reverse can be removed from the discussion. Just to give you a visual there, now notice not just gender but race, because patriarchy and white supremacy are deeply entwined. Right? This, get a little culture in here, 2015 cover of Vanity Fair. Again, in case you thought we didn't live in an androcentric society. I made this slide, I don't know who this guy is, but I just picked my archetype of a white guy. Of the people who directed the 100 top grossing films of all time across the world, 99 of them were men and 95 of them were white. The point is the incredible position to disseminate your worldview across the, not just your society, the whole world. And because, due to class and gender and race, these men are the most likely to be at the top of the hierarchy. They are the least likely to have authentic, sustained, cross-racial relationships. They may certainly have people of color who serve them, but not authentic relationships. I'm not saying they don't have any. They're less likely to have them. And yet they get to represent the other, and they get to shape how we see the other. Right? Again, power. Now, Facebook puts out these happy holiday things, and on August 26th, they put out Happy Women's Suffrage Day. Okay. Which women got full access to the vote in 1920? And this is another way that oppression works, right? The dominant group's experience stands in as representing everybody, right? So while we were oppressed as women, we were privileged as white. The understanding of that is called intersectionality. So racism is a form of institutionalized oppression. We're going to walk into white supremacy here, but we have to lay down what the society is, how it works, and how it shapes us. It is a system, and it results in unequal distribution of resources between white people overall and people of color overall, with white people the beneficiaries of that distribution. All systems of oppression can allow for exceptions. The rule will be the reproduction of power and resources in the hands of the group that controls the institutions. So again, no, there is no form of reverse racism. And if we just look at one group in particular, and we can think about it as state-sanctioned organized crime against African Americans, 246 years of brutality and enslavement, the rape of black women, medical experimentation, slave codes, black codes, sharecropping, disenfranchisement, mandatory segregation, bans on black jury service and voting, bans on testifying against whites, lynchings, mob violence, imprisonment, disempowerment, bans on interracial marriage, redlining, employment discrimination, educational discrimination, bias laws, white flight, cultural erasures, subprime mortgages, mass incarceration, racist media representations, and so much more. And notice all the way into the present, take that in, African Americans have never been and are not in the position to ever do this to white people. White people have always been and continue to be in the position to do this to African Americans. I'm going to repeat myself, there is no reverse form of racism. And no, they're not just as racist as we are. Everyone's just as biased as everybody else. Despite this, what are we taught that racism is? Well, we're taught that it's just an either-or proposition about good people and bad people. Good people are against racism and bad people are racist. And we saw them on the news in the 60s, and they had fire hoses and they were beating people at lunch counters, and those were racists. And if we were against that, we were not racists. And that has functioned beautifully to prevent the white collective from understanding what racism is and actually protecting racism, because it makes it virtually impossible to talk to the average white person about the inevitable absorption of racist perspectives and worldviews by virtue of being raised in this culture. I think this either or, good, bad, is the root of virtually all white defensiveness. Have you guys noticed any white defensiveness? Okay. All right. So, we know what our racists are like. Ignorant and bigoted, prejudiced, mean-spirited, old. You know they're old, because when the old people die off, there isn't going to be any more racism. Have you heard that one? Yeah, I don't actually think the young people's narratives are any more transgressive. So I didn't bring that up because I think it's true. But it is the narrative. Southern, I think around here they might live in Fife. What do you think, Fife? Or if you go north, Smoky Point. Yeah, Smoky Point. All right. Not racists are good, and we're educated, progressive, open-minded, well-attended, young, northern. We shop at Whole Foods. No, actually, we don't shop at Whole Foods because that's a corporation. We shop at PCC. We live on Finney Ridge, but we're moving to Portland. I like to make fun of white progressives. I think I said this. Because I am one, and I just know the consciousness, right? So we need to forget this. If you're feeling defensive right now, it's probably one. I am suggesting all white people have internalized a racist worldview and investments in racism and racist patterns. Yes, I am. And I'm also not granting you individuality. And that might be triggering some defensiveness. And see if it isn't rooted to this, but then ask yourself how it functions. It functions to protect your position, right? So it is inevitable. Just want you to think quickly about a couple things. No, I'll actually have you do it. I want you to turn to your neighbor and quickly share your answer to two questions. How racially diverse was your neighborhood growing up? And what messages did you get from the geography of race, not from what you were told, but from the geography of race? We'll start there. Go ahead. Check in with your neighbor. I'm just going to show you these two questions. The next one would have been asking you about your teachers. And I will just say that if you are like most white folks, those of you who are white, you most likely grew up in primarily white environments. You most likely had primarily white teachers. So when we think about messages, right, we need to think about who our role models are, what worldview is consistently conveyed to us, right? And our teachers most likely, because the teaching force in the U.S. is 83 to 93% white, most of our teachers grew up in racial segregation, only ever had white teachers. So what I'm trying to do right now is help reveal the foundation, not what you believe right here, what you would profess to believe in around racial justice, but the deep foundation that has us continually reproducing the racial inequality that we profess to be against. That's our question. Why, if we're against racism, do we keep reproducing it? We've got to go deeper than what we're consciously aware of, right? All right, so messages. The explicit message is everyone's equal. Not everybody. My dad actually wasn't somebody who said everyone's equal, but I lived in a society where I understood that was the right thing, right? But the implicit message is that, no, everyone is not equal, right? And so what messages do we get? Well, it's normal to live apart, obviously, because very few people are saying there's a problem here. If anything, they're probably saying you live in a good neighborhood if it's primarily white. Think about what a powerful message that is. It's natural to live apart. It may even be righteous to live apart because, you know, we're better people, we have nicer things because we work hard and we take care of our stuff, right? So these are the kinds of words we use to describe white space. And I want you to think about what this does to your identity. And that also this idea that there's not really race in a white space. That race is over there, or to what they have, and if they come into the space, now race is in the space. I often ask people to, with those two questions, there's a third question, what are some of the ways in which your race has shaped your life? It's very common for white people to tell a story about their first cross-racial encounter. Right? Or some kind of cross-racial encounter. Now, keep noticing. The question is, what are some of the ways in which your race has shaped your life? And telling about a cross-racial encounter or a moment you became aware of race is not actually how race shaped your life. You should be answering that question from when my mother was pregnant with me. Seriously. Where I could be born. What kind of nutrition was available to her? What kind of education? What kind of transportation? What kind of environmental safety? Where was I delivered? Who delivered me? Who owned the hospital I was delivered in? And who came in that night and mopped the floor? I was born into a racialized hierarchy in which we can literally predict how long people will live based on their racial assignment. That's how we should be answering that question. But we tend to always tell about this time that we had this friend, and it just shows how much we don't see ourselves as racial, and we don't see our environments as racialized when they are living and breathing and teeming with race, and they are the result, of course, of decades of policies and practices. They are not flukes or natural. And so we are forming our identities within those spaces. And of course, by definition, black and brown space is none of those things. We already did this. Yeah, anybody seen this image? This is from the College Jeopardy Champion Playoffs. These are our best and our brightest here, and this is an actual photograph from the playoffs, and that's the board at the end of the grand champion round. And as we can see, there was one category nobody touched because nobody was gonna risk losing. It must have been a pretty hard category. It's just one image. I just think it so powerfully captures this incredible disconnect from who we are, where we came from, and our history. So this leads to this kind of idea that racism is only intentional dislike by mean people, and that if we're against it, we're free from it, even as we grow up in a deeply racist society in segregation, where we're given messages about that segregation. It leads to these kind of narratives, right? I was taught to treat everyone the same. Anybody ever hear that one? Okay, so not one single person in this room was taught to treat everyone the same. Not one single person in this room, including me, was taught to treat everyone the same. And what I mean by that is you can't be taught to do that. You can be told to do that. You cannot do it. You don't do it. You don't. You're human. And we have copious research showing this. And honestly, what is revealed in that claim is a basic lack of understanding of socialization, culture, and a lack of self-awareness. You're not actually convincing people of color. I know there's not a lot of people of color in the room, but when white people say this to you about racism, are you convinced that we're the good ones? Okay, do you all hear that? Okay. I see people as individuals, it's in the past, it doesn't have any meaning. These are all very colorblind narratives, right? And they basically say, I don't see it, or if I see it, it doesn't mean anything to me. And I'm hoping you understand that you do see it, it does have meaning, much of which is unconscious. This is empirically demonstrable, and so this just functions to deny and protect. Well, what are those ones that shop at Trader Joe's and live on Finney Ridge? What do we say? By the way, I don't live on Finney Ridge. I couldn't afford Finney Ridge. But we say things like this. Oh, I work in a very diverse environment. I'm actually not sure anybody in this room could say that, but maybe, I don't know. I have people of color in my family. I used to live in New York. I have heard this, or this one gets used interchangeably with, I used to live in Hawaii. I'm not racist, I'm from Canada. And I'm not racist, I was in the military, because there's no racism in any of those places. Okay. Sociologists call that the not racist by inoculation. I've been near people of color, and that freed me of my racism. Children are so much more open. In fact, by age 3, the research shows that all children who grow up here understand that it's better to be white. They don't miss the message. Not a person in this room missed the message, because you can't, because it's relentless. It is better to be white. And this leads to an internalization of superiority that is often maybe not conscious. Okay, I marched in the 60s. Great, thank you. If you did, but we didn't even know that race wasn't biological in the 60s, so it does not free you of all your racism for the rest of your life with no certification ever needed again, okay? That also is not convincing. I get it. You're against explicit racism. This does not free you of your participation and your conditioning in all the other forms. I already know all this. We don't like how white our neighborhood is, but we had to move here for the schools. These are the progressive, I embrace diversity narratives, but I want you to look at the first set, which is colorblind, and this set, which is color embrace. They all function the same. They exempt the person from any further examination. They take race off the table. Good to go, nothing more to see. I'm not racist. And in that, they protect racism. And you have to understand racism differently than these. These are all resting on a definition of racism as conscious dislike and intolerance of people of color. I want you to look at the narratives and see, could they be resting on any other definition? If this is your evidence for not being racist, your definition of racism is conscious dislike and intolerance to be near people of color. And that that invalidates all of the implicit bias, all of the deeper institutional ways that our lives are shaped. So we need to go up under there. And since we don't, I'm gonna have you do this. Let me turn to the person next to you, and if you are white, what narratives do you use? Be honest. It would be an exceptional person in this room who's white who doesn't use one of these narratives. Which one do you use, or which ones do you use? And if you were grappling with what I'm saying, how would you speak back to it? If you're a person of color, which ones really bug you? or which ones did I miss? Okay? Quick check-in. You're only going to get about 30 seconds, but I'm trying to engage you. I know that's not a lot of time. The good news is you're going to have this wonderful conversation facilitated after this. So, again, the question that always helps me is, how does it function? Not is it true, is it false, is it right, is it wrong? How does it function? Right? And that is how I tend to determine. Does it exempt, right? Or does it kind of engage me and my role? Because we all play a part. Okay, so just to... So Ruth Frankenberg uses this definition of whiteness, which you can think about as all the elements that hold white people up as the human norm, right, as superior. It is a location of structural advantage. So think about that as controlling the institutions, sitting at the tables where decisions are made that affect other people's lives. Just get that image of the film directors in your mind, right, for that first one. It is a standpoint, a place from which white people look at ourselves and at others. So think about the way we talk about neighborhoods. Think about what a good school is versus a bad school. Think about what a neighborhood is coming up versus coming down, right? This is how we look at ourselves and how we look at others. And third, it refers to a set of practices that are usually unmarked and unnamed, right? Let me think of an example of practices, the ways in which we talk about race, right? The ways, the defensiveness, right? The norms, okay. So sociologist Joe Fagan has this concept of the white racial frame, which is the deeply internalized framework through which we make meaning. And this is what I'm trying to reveal by looking at neighborhoods and teachers and messages and take us beyond or much deeper than the I'm against racism conscious level, okay? And all of this framework positions whites as superior and is reinforced across society. So I'll just start showing you some images. This one's really painful for me. This is six shirtless brown men kneeling at the feet of this white man. Maximize the power of your employees. This was on CNN. Most beautiful women from around the world are representing South Africa. There is a child supermodel, I'm sorry to say. This is her. World's most beautiful girl. So what I'm getting at is how white is always signifier as ideal. Okay. This is on a website right now. What would a scientifically perfect face look like? To be white is to belong, right? To belong in all of these settings, to not bear the psychic weight of racialization. How many of you have been to a wedding? If it wasn't all white, it was pretty close. And I want you to think about weddings. Weddings are our deep circles, right? Our friends, our families, right? It's never us, rarely ever us, that bears that psychic burden. So we internalize belonging. We're represented in the halls of power. We looked at gender earlier. And now let's look at race. House of Representatives, 78% white. The US Senate, 90. And I'm gonna show you a series of photographs now where you see a yellow border. Those are the people of color in that group. US senators, leaders of the largest US companies, U.S. Supreme Court, that needs to change, U.S. governors, U.S. top military advisors, people who decide which TV shows we see, people who choose which movies get made, people with the most influence over which books we read, people who decide which music gets produced, people who decide what news is covered, owners of men's pro basketball teams, owners of men's pro football teams, owners of men's pro baseball teams, presidents of Ivy League universities, our film directors, current cabinet. This is not actually meant to pick, I don't like Paul Ryan, I'll heads up, okay. but when I saw this picture, I just thought, this is what it means to be white. These are his incoming interns. To be white is to belong, to be included, to have opportunity, to have advantage, to have a networking. Can you imagine to be his interns? Picture, these are our future politicians. Picture, these are our future medical researchers. These are our professors, right? Now, keep noticing I'm making a case for why the term white supremacy is so descriptive for the society we live in. Right? Well, I don't know, there's more powerful image than God. I picked this because they don't have skin on, right? Even with their skin off, they're white. Adam and Eve, the first humans. The first humans did come from the continent of Africa. Constant message is it's better to be white. I talked about this with children. They don't miss the message. This is 2015's World's Most Beautiful Woman. Here's 2016's World's Most Beautiful Woman. This is what I mean, we're absorbing it constantly. These are this year's top five runners-up for Miss Teen USA. And yes, they are different girls. you have to concentrate, but they are. But I want you to take it in, right? Miss Teen USA. This is the group that they were drawn from. And it's so often, this is the one, two, back to the side. And because I know my people, it's highly likely that that young woman in the back is going to be all these white girls' evidence for why they're not racist. She was there, she was their friend, nobody had an issue with them, with her. Trying to get us to a very different understanding of what racism is, which is that this would be like this to begin with, and how it shapes us as white people. It does shape us. Racially affirmed throughout my childhood, I think this pretty much captures it from today. This is exported worldwide. No little girl misses the message of white as ideal. Reminded me a lot of that. Here's an image from The Blind Side, right? Constantly consuming. Remember who writes and directs these films, who gets to represent these spaces. And I want you to contrast that with the White Savior family. Look at that Christian benevolence. Look at that abundance, right? These are shows we pretty much all grew up with. They're all TV shows, hugely popular, about ideal friendships. So Seinfeld 90s, Sex City, or 80s, 90s, 2000s, Gossip Girl, and the current show is Girls. All of these shows about ideal friendship take place in New York City, arguably the most racially diverse city. Relentlessly, the message is, even amongst diversity, there's no inherent value in an integrated life. Okay? We're internalizing these messages. We can't not. And I'll close this piece by saying perhaps the most profound way that my life has been shaped by my race is that I could be born into, and by the way, this picture was taken in Columbia City. Again, even amongst diversity, we managed to segregate. I was born into, I could learn, I could play, I could worship, I could study, I could love, I could work, and I could die in racial segregation. And not one person who's ever mentored me or guided me has ever conveyed to me that I've lost anything. My wedding looked a lot like that. Why would my funeral not look a lot like that? Thank goodness it won't, because I've worked very, very hard. But if I simply follow the trajectory of my life, it would look like that. I could go to my grave having few, if any, authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships, and no one has ever suggested any loss. In fact, it would be described as a good life. I think it's actually the most profound message of all, and I want the white folks in the room to go very deep there as a box to open what we've internalized. So the fundamental message is there's no inherent value in the perspectives or experiences of people of color. And I bring it to the table, and I'm either not aware of it or I must deny it because it does not align with my professed beliefs, the actual way that I live my life. Right? So if we go under the surface of what's propping up what sociologists call new racism, this is what I think supports all of this. This idea that you're either racist or you're not, individualism, universalism, right? We can represent everybody, deep implicit bias. Notice that what I showed you was just internalized superiority, right? The banality of white as ideal. I showed you no violence. We could make a case that there's psychic violence in those images, but that's a whole nother layer of the explicit racism we've all heard. I actually wouldn't believe any white person who came up to me and said, never in my life have I heard a racist joke or comment. Right? So there's that whole layer. Internalized superiority, an investment in this system because it serves us, and then the power of segregation to hold it in place because we don't actually know other people's experiences or what's happening to them. And the only difference with who we were able to name this morning is that we have video now. It's not new. So when sociologists and racial justice activists use the term white supremacy, we're not using it in the traditional lay sense of hate groups. We are using it to describe. It is so descriptive. It is being used to describe this water that we're all swimming in. Right? That white as the human norm, as the ideal human, and everything else a deviation from that ideal, right? Thereby superior. It's so descriptive. So sociologist Charles Mills talks about white supremacy as the unnamed political system that has made the modern world what it is today. And it underwrites all other social contracts, and it's the only one that is not named or studied. We study fascism, we study socialism, we study democracy. We do not study white supremacy. And it is the underlying social contract for all other contracts. So white supremacy is not dependent on individual white people's intentions or self-image. It is a political system of domination. And this system is based on the historical and current accumulation of structural power that privileges, centralizes, and elevates white people as a group. And all white people are impacted by this system. You could be white and married to a person of color, you are still impacted by the system, you still have internalized these messages, you may have worked a little harder, but we cannot be free of them in our lifetime, right? So we can build the skills and the capacity to repair when we perpetrate actions from this place. But I don't know that we can get better at doing less harm, but I don't believe we can ever be completely free of it, right? And if you want to do less harm, you've got to go into the place of looking about at how you do it, not that you don't do it. Does that make sense? All right. So I think we got a moment to, how does insistence that we don't say white supremacy function in the conversation? And maybe before I get there, I need to say, I get it, I understand, I'm 60. I get it, I was taught to see white supremacy as hate groups in the KKK. And so what is on me now is to say, huh, she's up there using that, these letters, all this stuff that's happening in UU is using that term, and clearly UU is not a hate group. So I'm missing something. It's on me to get up to date. It is not on people who have focused and worked and studied on this to change their language for your comfort and to hold you in place. Okay? All right. Thank you. So, how does it function in the conversation? Discuss. The final question maybe to give you, I mean, I am ending with what we can do, but I want to leave you with, because it's the number one question I get when I give a talk, is okay, what do I do? So I want to put that question back on white folks and offer you to take this home with you. What about my life has enabled me to not know what to do about racism? What about my life has enabled me to not understand how people are using the term white supremacy today?